What's up, everybody? It's 5:30 on Wednesday afternoon, and unlike normally, I'm not dragging weary bones home. I somehow still have a ton of energy. Might have something to do with the monster salted caramel java that I had at lunch, but anyway, it is time for another episode of Homeward Path. This is the show by me. My name is Adam, and I'm an MTG dad, and I am recording this show for all of you at home who are like me and trying to play and improve at Magic. You're trying to do the best you can at Magic on a limited time budget or a limited financial budget, or if you're like me, both. I'm so far on a time budget that I'm recording this as I drive in the car on the way home from work, hence the name Homeward Path. Anyway, for those of you who've been following the saga, we're moving this week. By the time some of you hear this episode, we will be in the process of moving, finally. So that's kind of taken the lion's share of my time this week. But again, I still got some time to do some thinking and do some digging. I've been digging through a lot of deck list dumps. The Constructed Criticism Discord has been extremely active this week, and I've been scouring through a lot of deck lists. Just, I'm still not dead sure what I want to play, but I like a lot of what I'm seeing. And that's the hallmark of a healthy standard format. And I also got some time to do some thinking, so I thought I would share some observations I had with all of you about ways that other games that I play have helped me improve at Magic. Now, some of these I don't play currently, but I have played in the past, and regardless, there's some concepts that are like core tenets of those games that are just a small part and parcel of what Magic is. But by getting to focus on them in these other games, it gave me the opportunity to, once I started playing Magic again, or once I came back to Magic after playing these other games, really kind of iron out some of the issues that maybe I was having with that aspect of my game. So I thought I would share those things with all of you. But first, I would like to thank the people who make this show possible. It begins with the rest of the network over at ConstructedCriticism.com. Gang, they are abuzz with all kinds of new activity. The new show, Even Odds, with Mason and Trey. The flagship show, Constructed Criticism. I mean, we've got new things on the way there. Common Knowledge, Trophy Mages, the streaming. The Constructed Clash video series, Wednesday Night Warrior. Just all kinds of content. I am just extremely excited. So much so that I almost want to sing, but I'm not going to. But I am just extremely excited about all the things that are going on this network. And another thing you can get excited about is checking out our sponsor over at InGaming.com. Get excited about that 10% off you're going to get by using our promo code CCMTG10 at checkout. And you can get all your sweet, sweet playmat, deck box, sleeve, whatever accessory needs. Just do that. Check it out. It's well worth your time. Moving on. I'm going to start doing a segment each week because it feels a little bit disingenuous for me to talk about like high-level Magic play on a regular basis. So I'm going to start doing a segment each week and then just interrupt it when we have a big major event that I follow really closely instead of trying to like do your Google homework for you. So each week I'm going to spotlight a deck concept or an archetype in a given format that I just really like, or that I'm interested in, or that I just find appealing, or that I just really want to talk about. So this week, I thought I'd start with Standard and start with the deck that everybody seems to be crowning the best deck in Standard, at least at the current moment, which is Black-Green Midrange. And it is very much Black-Green Midrange, even though we have all these Jade Light Rangers and Golgari Fine Brokers and Carnage Tyrants. This is a base black deck. So for those who don't know much about the black-green midrange kind of formula right now in Standard, we've got these creatures starting at 2 mana and going all the way up your mana curve. From 2 all the way up to somewhere around 6. That the way they work is every time you resolve one of these creatures clean to the board, you are ideally getting at least a card and a half worth of value out of this creature. A good example being the Explore creatures. Explore is not necessarily always worth a full card because you're either dumping something in the graveyard or you're leaving something on top of your library, or the card you draw, if you ever draw a card, is always a land. So for me, in my head anyway, Explore is worth about half a card. Exploring twice, is it really worth a full card? I don't think it is. But, you know, they're a little bit underrate, but they're reasonable. And then when you set up any kind of a graveyard synergy with them, they feel a lot more powerful. And guess what? You're in green and black. And the Golgari really like their graveyards. And I talked a little bit about this before the rotation and in kind of preparation. This was not quite the deck I had in mind. This was not what I was anticipating being on the other side of this rotation, but I'm kind of happy it is. And then at 3 and 4 mana, you have kind of your power spell-based creatures where you're casting a spell and then getting a creature attached to them in Plaguecrafter and Ravenous Chupacabra in some number. Now, Plaguecrafter being an edict effect for everybody, but the fact that it can force them to sacrifice a Planeswalker is much more relevant than anything like a Fleshbag Marauder or a Merciless Executioner that preceded it. The fact that it has 2 toughness means it doesn't just embarrassingly die to Chainwhirler after making them sacrifice Runaway Steamkin. And the fact that if they don't have anything on the board, they have to discard a card is also super relevant. The card is just, it's the best version of that card that I've ever gotten to play with. So I'm really in for that. And then, of course, Ravenous Chupacabra, the correct way to evaluate this card is it is a murder that you're paying an extra colorless mana for to get a 2/2 creature out of. That's what you're doing. You're paying 3 mana to kill a creature, and you're paying 1 more to get a 2/2. So, I mean, at base efficiency evaluation, it's not a bad card. And then you have Golgari Fine Broker, Find and Finality, and Eldest Reborn to be able to recycle all of these things. And then somewhere at the top of your curve, you have some mixture at 6 mana of Izzoni, Carnage Tyrant, Vraska Relic Seeker, whatever other busted 6-drop you want to play. You know, the fact that you're in green and black, you have fairly clean mana, you have the ability to play Llanowar Elves or Druid of the Cowl if you want to ramp into these big top-end cards, but you can also just kind of play the attrition game, try to grind your opponent out, and then set up these haymakers when your opponent's low on resources. And then you still have some of the best interaction in the format in cards like Vraska's Contempt, Assassin's Trophy, and then, of course, the Chupacabra trigger, the Vraska Relic Seeker -3. If you play Vraska Golgari Queen, you've got her minus that is Abrupt Decay. I mean, that's fine. That seems great. So the idea being so many of your cards will trade for your opponents and then leave a body behind. That's the basic premise behind this deck. It's a lot like what Jund was in Modern, or Jund is in Modern even, but the slower nature of the standard format allows it to thrive in a much more meaningful way. Now, I mean, it's not a perfect deck. No deck is. Everybody's got some weaknesses. Everybody's got some flaws. To me, it feels like the biggest flaw for this deck is just kind of identifying the correct mix of interaction and threats, and the fact that you have so few actual threats. Ravenous Chupacabra is not a threat. It's a murder with a 2/2 attached to it. You're very rarely ever going to actually kill somebody with a Ravenous Chupacabra. Same goes for Golgari Fine Broker. Same goes for Plaguecrafter. Sure, you get enough of these things in play, your opponent can just die sometimes. But that's not how you're killing your opponent. Not in, you know, there's not a turning the corner thing unless you're in the new school where you're main decking your Carnage Tyrants and just kind of daring your opponent to have it. So, I mean, there's a lot to like, a lot to unpack about the black-green mid-range deck as a whole. And it's one of those archetypes that I'm really excited about because of the fact that it's so flexible. It can transition up or down the mana curve. It can go heavier on 2 and 3 and 4 drops and skimp a little bit on 5s and 6s to get under control decks and be able to just bury them in card velocity. You know, once you get to turn 4 and you can start double spelling, you can start going double 2-drop, turn 5, 3-drop, 2-drop, and just start burying your opponent under all these spell effects attached to creatures. You can get ahead, but then you can also play the more traditional mid-range role against aggro decks, it's just a lot to like. The biggest struggle with the deck is going to be making sure you've got the right 75, because that's the struggle with basically every mid-range deck ever. You have to make sure not only your main deck is fairly tight, you've got a good spread of answers, but then you want to make sure when you start to narrow your focus in the sideboarding decisions, you want to make sure you're making the right ones. So that's, for me, that's the kind of deck I feel like I get rewarded for playing the most, other than the tempo-centric decks that I typically like try to force. So I'm more than likely, this is going to be the deck that I end up on, just because of how good it is now. And I don't think it gets worse over time, you know, as it gains the ability to splash colors other than white or blue. You know, once this deck has the ability to splash red, I think the sky's the limit. So I'm just super in on green-black right now, as I was before rotation, but even more so now, seeing what we actually have at our disposal. So that's going to wrap up the deck spotlight for this week. And we're going to move on, because the other thing I've been thinking about a lot this week, I got a chance to really kind of just sit down and think about it, and it was also brought to my attention when I finally sat down and listened to constructive criticism from this week, because Spencer made a point about learning to play Odd Paladin in Hearthstone, teaching him something about playing his more aggressively slanted decks in Magic. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, like, there's a lot that I've learned from other games that made me better at Magic once I started playing Magic again, or once I switched back to Magic after playing them. But the three biggest ones came from the three games that I learned the most from. The first one was Yu-Gi-Oh! And I know I'm going to get like lit on fire in comment sections everywhere for this, for admitting that I have played it, and not even just when I was a kid. It's actually been within the last 3 years. That was the game I was playing before I came back to Magic most recently. So, you know, have fun. A lot of people still do. But it's a very fast-paced game, and at the time I got out of Magic, I had gone through the Callblade format in Standard. I was going to have difficulty buying in on the other side of a Standard rotation, and I just decided to give myself a break, because I was kind of burning out on trying to keep up with the grind, even at the FNM level. So I just gave myself a break. I wanted to kind of step back, reevaluate, do something fun for a little while, and I ended up finding my old Yu-Gi-Oh! Collection. That's when I started playing it again. And the more I played it, the more competitive I got, because that's just apparently how I am. I can't do anything halfway. And one thing led to another. I ended up enjoying the game quite a bit. And one of the reasons I did is because there were some elements of my Magic game that were able to translate. The concepts of card advantage, the concepts of tempo, you know, little bits and pieces that were coming from Magic, but there was one element to Yu-Gi-Oh! That was unique to Yu-Gi-Oh! And that was the idea of just sometimes being dead. So there were two major things that you learn from that kind of game, a game that fast. The first is how to interact with unfair strategies in a meaningful, fundamental way, like how to shake them in a fundamental manner. Because nearly every strategy in Yu-Gi-Oh! Is unfair at the competitive level. If their deck can't kill you in one fell swoop from full health, they're not trying hard enough. You know, with an easily executed 3-4 card combo that the first card fetches the second card, which goes and gets the third and fourth. Like, that's what it felt like a lot of the time. If you can't kill your opponent in one fell swoop, you're not trying hard enough. Or if you can't, you need to be able to make it to where they just can't actually play the game. Those are the two types of decks that are the most prevalent, at least in my experience playing Yu-Gi-Oh! There are very few kind of grind-em-out decks where you kind of just do a thing and then steadily go up a half a card or a whole card on your opponent slowly over the course of a game. The unfair decks are just too good at killing you. They can grind through your protections and then just, you know, annihilate your face. So when you were interacting with these decks, you had to try to cut them off at the knees. think the powerful sideboard cards in Modern, but you had to ratchet that up to 11 because you had to do that like right away or you were dead. So being able to select the correct interaction for these unfair strategies and being able to play the right, in the case of Yu-Gi-Oh! It's 70 between your main deck, extra deck, and sideboard. But, you know, playing the right 70, making sure you had the correct tools for what you were expecting to face. You could argue a little bit of that as the metagaming skill coming over from Magic, because I had a fair amount of success with this. Not on any kind of like major level, but just at the local level, I got my fair share of prizes over the course of the 3 years that I was trying to do this. But the idea of being able to just cut your opponent off at the knees and know that whatever they try to do this turn, you can knock that out from under them and you won't die. And making sure you have the right tools for the right matchups that you anticipate. And going with that is the concept of turning the corner, which is to say when you have a hole in what your opponent's doing, when your opponent tries to do something and you foil their plan, being able to then flip the game on its head and put your opponent on the back foot, make them have answers, make them interact with what you're doing. That's something that is definitely not unique to Yu-Gi-Oh!, but the way you have to do it in that game is unique because you have to flip the game now to a point where they are dead or dying on the spot, and they have to either try to kill you again with a more fragile setup, or they have to break your board and then give themselves time to try and reset. It's a tug and pull that really, it was made for some really intriguing gameplay. But ultimately, for me, it was not as rewarding in those regards as Magic is. But it was definitely a skill that, once I started playing Magic again, translated over very well. And is a big part of the reason why I tend toward these kind of mid-rangey decks now, because they allow me to best maximize both of those skills. The ability to play a lot of different and effective sideboard cards, and the ability to, once your opponent's slowed down, once they're forced into playing more of a fair game of Magic, you can just kind of bludgeon them over the head with these powerful cards that you've got at your disposal. The next game that I've played a lot, and I still play it, it's my at-work, every-break game, and me and my friend Lance play it. He's another Magic player. We talk about the correlations between the two games all the time. It's one a lot of you know, and that game is Hearthstone. And the biggest thing I've learned from Hearthstone is how to properly leverage tempo and play and like board advantage. Because outside of a very, very small number of decks, and I'm talking like specifically Odd Warrior and, you know, Control Mage, sometimes Druid, very rarely will you have complete control of the game ever. So the concept of being able to play with a little bit of tempo, to be able to interact with your opponent and progress your board at the same time, being able to trade under mana efficiency so that you can continue to do things in the same turn, is intrinsic to Hearthstone. It's one of the biggest tenets of that game because you're not allowed to play on your opponent's turn. So you don't have the inherent mana advantage of being able to play on your opponent's turn and then untap. Even when you're playing the cards that trigger on your opponent's turn and you can force them to waste mana, you've had to then waste that mana on your turn to set that thing up. And if your opponent's a savvy player, they can trigger that secret ahead of time. They can use the card that they don't mind losing to trigger the secret in order to force through the thing that they want, similar to how a lot of players try to force stuff through counterspells and Magic. But it goes beyond a lot of that. And like it's all over the place. But the idea of being able to leverage, just not trying to control the game outright, but just trying to make sure you can stay a little bit ahead, is something that I really enjoy. As somebody who likes leveraging tempo and Magic anyway, Hearthstone has just ratcheted that love of mine up to about a 15. Not an 11, it's like a 15. I love doing that. My favorite deck to play in Hearthstone right now is Tespionage for fans of Brian Kibler. I don't have the Legends yet. I'm working on that, but it's a ton of fun to play. Just being able to leverage a lot of cheap card draw or just volume card draw on cards like Sprint, and then being able to get paid off for it with these really cheap cards that you've used to set everything up earlier. It's just a ton of fun. You have the ability to play a long game, but you also have the ability to, you know, come out swinging hard and put your opponent on the back foot, make them interact with you, knowing that you have access to cards like Feldori Strider and Academic Espionage to win a long game anyway. You know, it's a really, really fun deck. And by playing it, I feel like I would be more comfortable if I were handed something like Mono Blue Tempo to sit down and play with. Because a lot of the basic tenets are the same. You play a big thing, and you try to get a little bit ahead of your opponent, and then just keep them about that same level. Don't let them catch up. Don't let them get ahead of you. So, I mean, that's the biggest thing that I've gained from Hearthstone is even more of a competency and probably a little bit more of an unhealthy obsession with playing with tempo. And then the last one is a game that I've been playing for a long time, and I don't play it a ton, but it's one that I feel like has helped my limited play. What little limited I get to play, I feel like this game has helped my limited play more than any other that I've ever played. And that game is Ascension. It's one of the original deck building games designed by Justin Gary and Brian Kibler was a big part of it. That's actually how I met Brian Kibler in 2011 at Gen Con, was through Ascension. I got sent up there because of my store's beta testing with that game. They sent them to Gen Con to create networks and, sweet things of that nature, networking and, getting to unload some inventory and all that good stuff. I got sent up there because at the time I was working for my LGS in Goose's Computers and Games, and Goose's child was being born. So I got sent up there, and I got to, thanks to the beta testing we did in the store, I ended up getting to talk to Kibler about his game, which was just a surreal experience in and of itself. But for those of you who don't know, the basic tenets of Ascension are, ironically, fairly similar to Magic. You have runes and power. You have two different kinds of resource that you manage every turn. And you try to maximize those resources to build the best deck you can out of the cards that are presented to you by the game as it goes on. And there are archetypes built within the game. There's, the Lifebound, the Void, the Enlighten, there's several different archetypes built into the game anyway. The mechs or mechanas, I mean, there's just a handful of different archetypes built into the game that the more of them you get, the better your deck gets. So you would think it would be this weird kind of arms race to get the best one of those, except each one of them plays a different kind of game, and then there's a lot of bleed over between them. And there's different ways to attack the strategy of closing the game out, because the way the game ends is there's a pile of honor tokens, and then the game ends when the honor token pile is gone. So once the finite amount of honor is earned by all the players in total, the game ends and you count up how much honor you've earned between your deck and your spoils of victory. So you have some decks that want to try to maximize the honor value of their deck by getting aggressive on the runes, which are kind of like your mana, versus other decks that want to try to drain that honor pile as quickly as possible by trying to maximize their power, which is almost like playing with creatures, and defeat the monsters in the center row, which will allow you to gain those honor tokens and hurry up and close the game out that way. And the ability to be malleable, to recognize what's available to you, recognize the clearest path you have to a straightforward plan as the players around you are trying to do the same thing, it does wonders for your limited game in Magic. Now, I do not consider myself any kind of a limited guru. I just don't actually play enough limited Magic to know for sure. But playing Ascension, I can say, has made me a lot more confident as a limited player. I'm much more open to flipping in the middle of a draft and to recognizing what's open. You know, there was a draft that I played, Hour of Devastation, draft weekend. I kind of went on a whim. I was just going to trade some cards in, but when they asked me if I wanted to draft, I asked Sarah, and she said, sure, go ahead. And I ended up drafting, and I initially was going to try to go into some kind of a red-black deck, or I was going to try to go into a red-white deck. And then I started getting all these good removal spells and counter spells and card draw spells in red and blue. So the more these cards got passed to me, the more of them I took, and I ended up drafting a blue-red control deck that didn't drop a game. I had Enigma Drake, Double-Striped River Winder, and Abandoned Sarcophagus in my draft deck. It was a little disgusting. So, you know, the idea of being flexible, being able to take what everybody's giving you, being able to take what's presented to you and figure out a clear path to a strategy is something that really got a lot smoother for me, a lot easier for me from playing Ascension. And I mean, that's really what it boils down to. That's the point I'm trying to drive home. Huh? Anyone? Drive home? Drive? Anyway. We didn't get any submissions for dad jokes this week, so I'm doing the best I can. Bear with me. The point I'm trying to drive home here is it's possible to learn things from other games by getting better at them that will correlate to helping you get better at Magic. You don't have to just slog through Magic until it becomes something you don't like doing anymore. Sometimes it's okay to back off, do something else, and then figure out how it can help you with Magic. And if you haven't tried any of these games, especially Ascension, I cannot recommend it highly enough. Like, every now and then we just break it out for board game night, and it's a great time. So, you know, do yourself that favor of occasionally just step back, do something a little bit different, do something fun, do something that, while it may evoke feelings of Magic, you know it's definitely not Magic. And you'd be surprised how much that can help you once you come back to Magic at recognizing things you maybe didn't before, or, you know, uncovering play patterns that maybe you didn't see before. So with that, we're going to wrap up this week's episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you would like to become a part of the discussion, you know, help me come up with great ideas for future episodes, things you want to hear about, you can send them to me on Twitter. I'm at HomewardPathMTG. You can send them to me on Facebook. My name is Adam Spain. I try to return messages when I can. If you don't want to have to worry about messages getting returned, or you don't want to, you know, go out on that limb, you can join either of the Facebook groups. The Homeward Pathfinders is the one specifically for this show. Excuse me. Sorry, Tennessee is killing me right now. It's like 35 degrees in the morning and 60 degrees when I get off work. It's trying to actively destroy my lungs. Anyway, you can join either one of the Facebook groups. The Homeward Pathfinders is the one for this show, or you can join the Constructed Criticism family, which is the one for the network as a whole. Either of those should be open invite. All you have to do is send a request to join, and you should reasonably be approved as long as you're not, you know, a horrible person. So, if you have heard anything, you know, if you want questions, comments, concerns, if you want to do anything that you think would help the show, please let me know. I will be glad to take ideas into consideration. And with that, because we didn't have any submissions for my favorite segment this week, I'm not going to bother. So thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you have a good week. I'm looking forward to getting moved, and this is going to be the last episode sent from this house. So I look forward to submitting the next one from the studio in my new one. And I will catch you then.